Hey, everybody, it's Jeff Dunham. Welcome to another episode of the Jeff Dunham Podcast. And along with me right now are my buddies Matt McNeil and Jeff Rothman. Hey. Gentlemen, how are you today?
Doing good. Well.
Good. Yeah.
Doing all right.
Good. So today we're going to talk about a guy that we've all met, we all know fairly well, right? You know Jay Leno.
Yeah. I got to meet him actually when I was a teenager watching him. He used to do these appearances on Letterman before he ever took over The Tonight Show. And I became a huge fan. He was so sarcastic, felt like he was from, you know, a little like, you know, more of my generation.
Right.
And then went to see him and he put on a 2.5 hour show, just jokes for 2.5 hours.
Oh.
And completely clean, but still with an edge. And I was just blown away. I'd never seen anyone do that long.
And wait, that was at a comedy club?
It was actually in a bigger, it was a bigger venue. It was like a big club. It was more of a music club that, right. And comedians who got a lot more than the usual comedy clubs would play there.
And you got to meet him after. You got to meet him afterwards?
Well, got to meet him afterwards. Very encouraging. I told him I wanted to be a comedian and gave me some advice. And so really nice guy. So funny. And
yeah.
I just couldn't believe you could be that funny for that long.
Wow.
So that blew me away. And
yeah.
Then years later, I ended up on The Tonight Show. So full circle. And then it was over.
then it was over. and then you started working for me.
Yeah.
Oh, well.
No. It was just beginning then.
Yeah.
New door opened.
And Matt,
but that's the thing about Leno is I don't think that everybody realizes that where he came from, like the comedy club circuit. Like, I mean, he was an amazing like club comedian. Like I go to the improv and I see pictures of him like at the age of 23 on the walls. You know, I mean, that guy was in those clubs.
Well, you hear that in the interview. And we talked about that a lot. I taped it with him a couple of days ago. And and I've known Jay for a good amount of time because I was, you know, I did guest spots after being on with Carson a few times. Then Leno took over and I did some of the sketches with Walter and some of the goofy sketches, and I got to know him that way. But then, Matt, you and I got to know him better because of the car shows, right?
That's right. Yeah, no, that's it was kind of a surreal deal for me, like sitting in the back of a, you know, a Suburban or something, and Jay Leno's in the front and we're just sort of like all having a conversation while we're waiting for the crew to set up or whatever. But totally like super nice, like personable guy, like genuine, and
yeah.
But
I meant the car shows at Supercar Sunday is when.
When
he
that's
would
the
show
other thing.
Up.
He just shows up and
yeah.
You know, in some giant steam thing and just like
giant
shakes
steam
hands with his babies.
I know people make fun of me for some of my cars, but it's like I could just the same way go. You know, I may have a Pinto, but Jay has like things powered by steam.
That's like his thing, right? He loves
it
the
is.
Steam car.
And obviously that holds much more weight than my stupid Pinto or my Pacer. The steam thing is much cooler, but still.
I think it depends on your audience.
I guess.
Ooh, Pinto. Yeah.
Oh, well. But yeah, so it does. He shows up just like a normal guy, showing up driving something crazy and weird. And also in L.A., if you drive around enough, you'll find Jay Leno driving a car around. I mean, he even took his Ferret Scout car, the tank, and was driving it around Beverly Hills after he got it. It's not a tank. It has tires on it. But yeah, and you'll hear stories from people saying, I saw Jay Leno broken down on the side of the highway every once in a while. And he'll just be sitting
Yeah, like waiting. Literally everyone I know has that, like has a story about I was in traffic beside Jay Leno. Before I knew him or met him through you,
yeah,
I have a story on the freeway. I look over, hey, it's Jay Leno at a Corvette.
Yeah, and he waves at everybody. He's always friendly. He never tries to hide from it. You know, so that's I think that's one thing that's unusual about Jay. Same thing with Howie, is that they... Same thing with Gabe. All the guys I've interviewed, they all welcome the publicity. They welcome saying hi to people. It's great.
Yeah, they're pretty down to earth.
Yeah, yeah. So I've picked all down to earth guests so far.
So far.
Yeah. All right, great. All right, so what else can you say? I had a really great chat with Mr. Jay Leno, and I think you'll enjoy it. Here he comes.
All right.
Well, folks, I'm joined by a guy who has been coming into our homes for 45 years plus now. Mr. Leno, how are you?
Good. How are you, Jeff? Good to see you.
Great. We had a much better introduction of you with the other two guys, so we gave a lot of accolades and said some nice things about you.
Oh, well, that's very kind.
Well, I appreciate you letting me do this with you today.
Thank you.
You know, I just want to start with the weirdest thing I can possibly think of. I'm going to get to some of the typical questions that folks just want to know, and they might not have heard your answers. But
right.
Could you please tell us the last time you had a piece of fruit or a green vegetable?
Oh, green vegetable.
Come on. You've told me this story three times, and it kills me.
1962. I'm not a big vegetable. Here's how bad it is. The guys wanted BLTs.
Right.
So I said, I'll go to the market. I got bacon, which I eat all the time. I got some tomatoes. I come home.
You're talking about your crew?
The guys. I was going to make them BLTs. I came home with what I thought was a head of lettuce. And they go, what's this? Lettuce. They go, no, that's cabbage. What? Oh. I went, oh, I'm sorry. I don't eat lettuce or cabbage. I don't know which one it was. But, so, yeah, no, I'm just not. I'm a carnivorous person. I'm just not a vegetable guy.
That doesn't go far enough. You have to tell them the last time you had a bite of an apple. You have to tell that story.
Well, no, that goes back to the early 80s. I checked into a hotel in Austin, Texas, and there was like a bowl of apples sitting on the you know, when you check in the hotel.
Sure.
The guy said, "Do you like an apple?" And, you know, as a comedian, free food, you know, okay.
Right.
I said, yeah, okay. So I took this apple. I took a bite. I got in the elevator. I was like, I went up to my room. I was like, I got in the shower. And for over an hour, I stood like just rinsing my throat until finally my voice came back. There was Alar or something. Remember that thing they used to spray on apple?
Sure.
I must have been allergic to it. But I couldn't speak. So that was my last apple, was about 82, 83.
And no fruit, no vegetables. I mean, when you go to your place and, you know, craft services is set up, it's always a great meal because there's no vegetables and fruit. You don't have to mess with that. It's all meat and cheese and bread.
Chicken wings, fabulous!
It's amazing to me. All right, it's fine. It's just funny. Now, do you remember? Before I get to questions about you, do you remember? You probably don't remember this. The time that you and I actually had a first conversation. I'll remind you of when it was. I had been on with Johnny a handful of times, and then I was on your show on the Tonight Show a handful of times doing the goofy sketches. Right.
Right.
We were getting on an American Airlines. I had to look up when this was. It was January of 1992. We were getting on an American Airlines flight. We were like a row apart, and you and I started talking. And it was just when Jennifer Flowers had accused Bill Clinton of the 12-year affair.
Oh, right.
Yeah. And you and I were both like, well, he's done. We're never going to hear from him again.
Oh, yeah, I remember. That's okay. Yeah, I do remember that.
Yeah. And so we were kind of wrong on that one.
We were wrong on that one, but ultimately, if you wait long enough, we were right, because he has not said a word since the whole Me Too movement started. You know, remember he had a book? He had a book that came out.
Sure.
And on the first book interview, they asked him about, do you regret the way you treated some of these? And that was it. The book tour was canceled. Have you heard him speak anywhere? So actually, I would say, Jeff, we were ahead of our time.
Okay, I'll go with that. All right. So one of the first things I want to point out that a lot of people don't know, Jay, is like I knew you from The Tonight Show because you came out to L.A. in the mid-70s. Is that about right?
Yeah, early 70s, yeah.
Okay. And because you grew up in New York and...
Well, I was born in New York, but I really grew up in Massachusetts. I lived in New York till I was 9 years old. Then we moved to Andover, Massachusetts, which is about 30 miles north of Boston. It's near the New Hampshire border. I mean, now there's Route 495 and Route 93. But by then, it was just a kind of a sleepy little kind of agricultural town. Now it's one of those, you know, $5 chocolate chip cookie towns, you know, that's within commuting distance of Boston since the freeways went in there, or the highways, as they call them back east. But, yeah, it was a pretty quiet place.
So who were you in high school? I mean, you know, you talk about the class clowns, and I don't think comedians ever end up – they weren't the class clowns. Is that about right? Successful comics? I just don't hear that.
No, that is completely wrong, actually. I was a class clown.
Really?
You know what's interesting? I was lucky. I grew up in a, I had very good teachers. I had teachers that were career teachers. You know, here in LA, people teach high school for 2 years and they write a screenplay. Or I'm just doing this again. I'm working on room 222, so I'm teaching for a couple of years. You know, but I had career teachers, and I remember, and I'm dyslexic, so I was a terrible student. Jay has the ability, but does not apply himself. You know, and
sure.
So one day, Mrs. Hawks, who I thought was probably 70, but she's probably 30 when I was, you know, 14 or 15.
Right.
She pulled me aside in the hall and she said, you know, I always see you joking around and telling jokes and things. I want you to take my creative writing class. Instead of English, instead of taking regular English class, we'll give you credit for your creative writing class. And why don't you write down some of these funny stories that you always seem to be telling people in the hall and you read them to the class. And I went, oh, okay. And for the first time in my life, I actually enjoyed doing homework. It was like I went home and I wrote the story out and then I read it to myself. No, let me change that to this. And, you know, and it was the most time at it because I always did homework. Excuse me, is this going to be on the test? No? Okay, thanks. And, you know, that was my attitude. But this time I really enjoyed doing homework. And I went to class and I got up and I read the story. And, you know, it was a kid's thing. So it got some laughs. It was okay. And she said, oh, have you ever thought of being maybe a comedy writer or maybe even a comedian? And when you grow up in a little town near the New Hampshire border, the idea of being a what? Being on TV, I don't know what. I remember Mrs. Langdell, my next door neighbor, said, you can't be a comedian unless your father was a comedian. That's the law in California. That's the way it works. The father has to have been a comedian.
Right.
You know, and I thought, well, okay. And I thought, well, I guess I'll never be a comedian. But I remember Mrs. Hawks is very helpful. And sadly, like 6 or 7 years later, she died of breast cancer. And I set up a scholarship for kids that are, you know, a little different or maybe have some skill that's not readily visible. And it's still going to this day. And I was very lucky. You know, I grew up in that kind of town, like Mr. Robichaud and all the teachers I had. When I went back to my 20th reunion, they were still in the same homeroom that
wow.
we were in back in 1968. I mean, it was hilarious. And so I was very grateful for that. I was fortunate. So to answer your question, yes, I was the class clown, but I did obviously go on to be a comedian.
So before you moved out here, how many years were you doing stand-up out there?
My first time I got on stage was, I think, October 19th, 1969. I used to perform at a little club called Lenny's on the Turnpike in Boston. I was in a comedy group for a while. But the trouble with the comedy group, you got five or six people. Some want to work hard. Some are kind of lazy. And consequently, so I was, we had a gig this week. What do you want to get two gigs this week for? And it was like, no, let's get. So I only did that for a few months, and then I started to try and get out on my own. And I went to the Bitter End in New York and the Improv in New York. You see, this is before, back in the very late 60s, early 70s, America was very serious. It was Vietnam, you know, colleges, it was all stop your war machine, man, you know, walking with the signs.
Right.
And then that was sort of what there's like what they used to call it. What they used to have in Boston was you had literally hundreds of colleges with thousands of students with no money willing to be entertained by people with no talent. So, you know, they would put two candles in the cafeteria. That would become the Two Toke Cafe on a Saturday. And students would perform for other students, you know.
Right.
So nobody's doing comedy. I remember one guy had that thing where you put your flashlight under your chin, you turn it on. Click, stop your war machine, man, click, and then run to the other side of the room.
Right.
Stop your war machine. And this is what that was his serious sort of poetic interpretation.
Of course.
You know, so that's what it was. So doing comedy was really odd. I mean, I went to Emerson College, which was a good school, but it was a dramatic school. It was for the arts, but comedy was not considered the arts then. Now they have a huge comedy program. You know, Stephen Wright and a whole bunch of other people came out of there. But back when I was there, it didn't seem, nobody really took comedy as a profession seriously. So I didn't pay much attention. I was working gigs at night. I drive to New York almost every night of the week to try to get on the Improv and then drive back in time to be in class in the morning. And that's sort of how I got started.
So what made you decide to come out here to L.A.?
Well, what made me come out here was we all used to go to the Improv. And this is so funny because it's before VCRs, it's before cassette, before you could record a program.
You're talking about the New York Improv, New York City one.
Yeah, New York Improv. Mm-hmm. If somebody was on TV, you had to physically get to a TV at the time they were on, which seems ridiculous now.
Right.
But like when if a comedian was on The Tonight Show, or we go to the bar at the Improv at 11:30 and we turn it on and wait for the comedian to come on, you know. And Johnny was still in New York.
Right.
Then I think in 71 or 72, that was the last nail in the coffin. Johnny decided to move The Tonight Show to California. He'd been coming here for years for 3, 4, 5 weeks at a time.
Right.
Then they decided to move the whole show to California. And that left a huge void because there was nothing in New York. Now there's been a resurgence. You got the Today Show and all kinds of TV shows coming out of New York City. But in the early 70s, everything just went to California. And we figured, well, The Tonight Show was really the only show to be on. I mean, we did Merv Griffin and Mike Douglas, but The Tonight Show is the one that made you. So we said, well, let's go to where the show is. You know?
And you say we. So the other we's, what comics are we talking about?
I'm talking all the comedians, Richard Lewis, everybody. Mm-hmm. I remember one time Sonny and Cher came into the Improv, and they were looking for comedians. And we all auditioned. We didn't get it. The only one that got it was Richard Lewis. We were so happy for Richard.
Out of all you guys, it was Richard Lewis.
Well, I'll tell you the story. It's so stupid. Okay. And so, yeah, because he was further along than most of us. I remember once I was in New Jersey at a gas station. I saw the Bergen County News on it. So local comedian, Richard Lowe, I'd love to meet this guy sometime. So I went to the Improv. Oh, you're the guy in the Bergen County News. So we got to be friends. And anyway, we all auditioned for Sonny and Cher. And then we heard Lewis got it. He got flown to California to be on Sonny and Cher. I was like, oh, this is going to be great, you know.
Right.
So I can't remember what night of the week Sonny and Cher was. It might have been a Saturday night. It just shows you how things change. That was a big night for television.
Oh.
So we're all at the Improv at 8 or 9 o'clock, whatever time we're waiting for Richard Lewis to come on, you know. And then we see a sketch where it's like five people dressed as the Fruit of the Loom people. And I think Richard was a tomato or something. And he kind of danced across. And we're all like, hey. Oh, man. It was like, oh. Because we all thought he'd be up there. And nobody be funnier than Lewis.
Right.
He'd be doing his stand-up, you know, the whole thing. And hilarious.
That was it.
Actually, if you want to see something funny, Google Richard Lewis Candid Camera. When Rich was like 13, he was on Candid Camera.
Oh,
and they brought him into Dean's office to say, "Look, we've done the thing. You're best qualified to be a truck driver. That's true." He goes, "A truck driver? I can't drive." He was still Richard Lewis even then, that character. But I want to go to college. No, no, you're going to be a truck driver. No, but I can't drive. It was really a funny thing.
So you came out here, and it was I think what was it, 76 that you got your first role. On Good Times, and then there was One Day at a Time, then there was Alice, two episodes of Laverne and Shirley. So for most of your 102 credits, you've played yourself or a spoof of yourself, if I got it right. But right now...
Yeah, that's probably correct.
Okay, but right now, you're a recurring role in Last Man Standing, and you play, what's his name, Joe Leonard. So you're playing a car mechanic. So my question is, after after all these years, is it more fun playing yourself or the guy you could have been?
Well, it's just easier. I mean, obviously, look, I'm not an actor. I mean, actors, you know, you have to emote and I've got to get out of my skin. And I have to do this. I just like playing a various version of myself.
That's the mechanic. That kind of is you, isn't it?
Yeah, that's why they hire you, because, it's what the audience expects. Obviously, if I was doing King Lear, people would be, that seems a bit odd. Jay Leno is King Lear. So I guess I'm playing myself. That's correct.
Well, people say that you're the nicest guy in the world. And my joke is, and people tell me that I'm a nice guy. And I always, my joke is I fake my sincerity well. So
right. I can attest to that.
Thanks. Well, I got a story from Kevin Abbott, the showrunner on Last Man Standing. And this, I think this just happened. He said maybe it was the first time you were shooting with him. He said that you wouldn't go back to your dressing room. and you'd stay there and watch everything. And he said that some camera guy or a kid that worked on the show came up and said that asked you for your autograph for his dad. And you said, where's your dad live? What does he do? And he said, he's in Detroit. And you said, give me your cell phone. And you called the kid's dad and carried on a 15-minute conversation with the dad. Jay, right. that's typical you, isn't it?
You know, I like people. And to me, this is a people business. You know, I never understand people go, I hate signing autographs. I hate when people come up to me and want to, well, why are you in this business? I mean, I don't get it. I mean, it's that's sort of the fun part.
Do you enjoy watching yourself perform on TV, either the stand-up or the acting? Do you like it?
No, I can't say I enjoy watching myself. I mean, when I was on The Tonight Show, I'd watch the monologue to see, I did that joke right, or, damn, I should have done it this way.
Right.
I'll look at it for a technical point of view, but I'm not like Narcissus standing in the pool of water gazing at my own reflection. Oh, what a handsome man. That's more of a Dunham kind of thing.
I was going to say is I can't stand watching myself perform because I just...
Yeah, it's so funny. I can't stand watching you perform. I know exactly how you feel. Jeff, I'm sorry. You set yourself up for that. You know, if you put your face out there in a fight, you're going to get punched. I don't know what to tell you.
Screw the rest of my thought on all that. That's fine. forget it. All right, so most people know this. You had The Tonight Show with Carson from 92 to 2014. You were the permanent guest host before that. And then there was one little bump in the middle there with a thing that went on. So the defining moment that everybody always talks about is that Hugh Grant moment when he came on after he had been caught in the alley with, what was her name?
Divine Brown.
Yeah, it cracks me up. You always remember the name of the...
You should know. I mean, you gave her name to Hugh.
Exactly. Of course I did. So,
yeah. No, go ahead.
And I'm curious. So the line, of course, was he walks out, he sits down. You want to tell it? I don't want to screw it up. It's just one line.
He was booked on the show.
Right.
And we just assumed after he got arrested that he would cancel.
Right.
But he didn't. And I went in the dressing room and I said, hey, Hugh, thanks for coming. He goes, no, I know, I deserve it. He didn't come with a press person.
Right.
He didn't come with a load of excuses. You know?
Mm-hmm.
I said, look, I've got to ask you about this. He goes, fire away. I deserve it. I screwed up. Blah, 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 blah.
So good for him. That's amazing.
Yeah, yes. You know, truly a decent guy.
Yeah.
And you know something? It's sort of classic bad boy behavior. I mean, it's just one of those, ooh, naughty, what are you doing? You know?
Right.
And plus it had every – the British press loved it because it was sort of class warfare. The rich, posh, handsome actor – the poor black street girl. It was Pretty Woman in real life. You know what I mean?
Right.
Almost.
Wow.
And he walked out and I said, what the hell were you thinking? And everybody laughed.
Oh, man.
And he smiled and he goes, well, you know, I can't remember what he exactly said, but he hemmed and hawed a little bit, but he was quite funny. And I really give him a lot of credit because nowadays everybody immediately gets a press person and an attorney.
Sure.
And of course the what actually happened is completely different from what we just saw on the camera, you know. So
but yeah. For you in your career, that was the moment. And I remember I was watching it that night and I just went, that was fantastic. And
the interesting thing was we had switched our set. When I started The Tonight Show, I was in Johnny's set, and Johnny liked to have a lot of distance between him and the audience.
Right.
And there was about 50 feet, and then his audience went straight up. Actually physically in seating, almost like a Broadway theater, straight up seating.
Sure.
We had gone to New York once and did a week of shows and had success because the audience was right next to me, and I could come out and shake hands with people in the front row.
Right.
And how you doing, and high five people. I mean, I liked having the audience close. A lot of performers don't. And that really turned out, made it very personal because you could see the people right here smiling or laughing. Sir, what are you doing? And that kind of stuff like that. So we had started to catch up to Dave, and we would win maybe Monday. He would win Tuesday. We'd tie on Wednesday. He might win Thursday. So when Hugh Grant, you're talking about Letterman,
for the folks who don't know, you're talking about Letterman. Yeah,
yeah, Dave Letterman. Mm-hmm. When Hugh Grant came on, that was the big turning point. in the sense that, oh, a lot of people watched that night and then continued to watch. So, it was definitely, if you had to use something as a marker, that would probably be it.
That would be it. And so the ratings went up, and only a couple times did Dave beat you, like when he came back after his heart surgery, whatever that was.
Right.
And just a couple times, but you stayed on top the entire time, which is just amazing. Okay, let me ask you this. Besides that point right there, go before the Hugh Grant moment, was there ever another defining moment in the career as the career arc, as we've joked about?
Yeah.
Was there another moment like that before that catapulted you or gave you the fuel?
Well, I'll tell you something. Yeah. I always took the job, not the money. That was always my thing. I always wanted to work. The money came second. And I was, you might remember this, in the 80s, there was a time when there was revolving guest hosts. Johnny would take 15 weeks, 18 weeks a year off, and they would have revolving guest hosts. Sure. They had about six comedians, of which I was one. Mm-hmm. And I would say five or six of the seven or eight comedians who were doing this were all managed by the same firm. And one day I got a call from the manager. He said, hi, you know, I represent all the other comedy. I said, great, nice to talk to you. He said, listen, we're going to Carson Productions, and we're going to be asking $25,000 a show for our guys to guest host. We'd like you to join us.
Oh.
And at the time, I was doing for scale.
Right.
I said, that's okay. I'm making $512 a show. And they said, well, you can make $25,000 a show. I said, no, I'm happy. I'm just going to keep my $512 a show.
Yeah.
Okay. 3-4 weeks later, suddenly I'm named permanent guest host.
Wow.
Because I'm saving Carson a couple of $100,000 a month.
Sure.
I mean, he owns the show. I mean, he had a bunch of guys who are all kind of doing pretty much the same thing.
Yeah.
And it just taught me a lesson. You know, I always say, to this day, I have no idea how much it pays to be on Last Man Standing. I've never looked at a check. I don't care.
Right.
I just do it because I love Tim. I like to do the show. I try not to be a pain in the ass. I try to have my lines memorized. Oh, so they like having me around. And it's fine. And that's always been my attitude. If you're worth anything, they will come to you and offer you money.
Sure.
And I realize that sounds incredibly naive. But it's also paid off for me. You know, people always say, you know, you're real stupid to be doing that. And I go, hey, you're at the Oakwood Gardens, okay? You're in an apartment. I have a house here. Why am I stupid? Well, no, you shouldn't do this. Why?
Well, that's what I've always, you know, said to everybody around me, that the money is second, because if you do the work and you do great and you're easy to work with, then the money will come after that. And
that's right. And the weird thing is, the same show you get paid tens of thousands of dollars for is the same show you do when you go to the improv on Wednesday night and get up stage and do a half hour or 40 minutes. It's the exact same show.
Yeah.
And why is one free and one? I don't know, but I like the way it works, you know.
Sure. Well, then let me go to the opposite side of things and say, was there ever a time that you said, I don't know if this is going to work out? And I'm talking about before the Tonight Show and after, where you thought, nah, this is it, I'm done. And I'll get to the other question about why you never quit in a minute.
You know, I have to be honest and say no. Mm-hmm. I always enjoyed it. I always figured I would do something. I mean, if you consider being a salesman, you know, my dad was a salesman. He worked for an insurance company. And once a month, my dad, to inspire the men, because it was all men selling insurance in those days, to inspire the men, he would put on a little show in the office. He'd tell you, I'm going to show you I can juggle. And I remember he played the Frank Sinatra song, High Hopes, he had high. And my dad was trying to juggle eggs, and they were breaking on his face, and, you know, all this kind of stuff. But he kept doing it, and eventually he's really juggling the eggs, and the guys all applaud. And it was like a funny motivation thing. I thought, well, that's probably what I'll wind up. I'll be a guy like my dad. I'll maybe be able to do something funny a couple of times a week and then do my job. That's But that's before I ever even started. And once I got started in comedy, I vowed never to make a living doing something else. I'm going to try and make a living doing this. And because what happened, well, I had friends that were waiters and waitresses, and they would go out on auditions and do stuff. And then they're working as a waiter. Well, I want to get a nice apartment. God, I want to get a Camaro. I want to get a... and then pretty soon they can't go to auditions because they have to go to work to pay for the Camaro, whatever it might be. So I lived pretty frugally. It was that kind of just eat pasta every day and drive a crappy car and, you know, until you get yourself somewhere.
Well, that was my next observation is that, and this is a compliment, is that your life has been seemingly simple from the outside looking in, because you and Mavis have been married for 41 years now. Is that right?
Yeah, that's right. Yeah.
Which is nuts. That doesn't happen.
Yes, that's correct. I'm sure your wife will be thrilled to hear that, Jeff. You know,
well, Audrey and I have been married since 12, so right. I can't do math. But, you know, that's a pretty good
well,
run,
you know,
so
today,
far.
Marrying a 12-year-old would get you in trouble. But back in your day,
I mean
I'm sorry.
Yeah. Let me get back to my question. So my question is, you know, and you guys don't have kids, and you seem to have one hobby, and that's all over you right now. It's the cars. But also your hobby has become a job because you've, you know, have Jay Leno's Garage. You've had that since 2015. It's on, CNBC and on YouTube, highly right. successful. They keep renewing it. You keep doing episode after episode. So your hobby turned into the job. The stand up is now, you're constantly working. So I think that's also a rarity, because most people in show business or sports figures, whatever, they complicate their lives to where they don't have the luxury of saying, well, maybe I don't need that gig and I'm just going to keep doing it because I want to.
Well, plus it's also the fact that I like to work. You know, I use as my example, like everybody complains now about canceled PC and canceled culture and all that kind of stuff. But I remember in the 70s, I'll use an automobile reference here, when all the smog and emissions controls came in, all the American manufacturers went to Washington with millions of dollars with lobbyists. We can't meet these emissions. We need to, you have to roll them back. We can't do it. It's too hard. And the Japanese went to Washington and said, what are the rules? What do you want? What do you want the emissions to be? Okay, is that the hard and fast rule? That's the maximum? That's the minimum? Thank you. They went back to Japan. They developed engines like the Honda, what's that, CVCC, whatever it is, without motors, and came back with a fuel-efficient, good-mileage, powerful car. And the Americans are stuck with all these smog controls and cars choking to death and couldn't get them to run right. And that's when the Japanese began to win that particular war. We're fortunate now in that all the major, especially American companies, are run by engineers. They're not marketing guys. They're not guys that came from Whirlpool or GE now. They're guys that grew up in the auto industry, are true engineers, understand how mechanical things work and operate. And you've got a lean, you know, GM is really lean and smart. A brilliant car is a new Corvette for $60,000 is almost, there's not another country in the world that can build a car of that quality for that kind of money. You have to go to Italy and pay 3 to 4 times that to get a Lamborghini or Ferrari with comparable power. So I think it's pretty good. And that was my attitude. You know, I would say, okay, what are the rules now? Okay, you can't do these kind of jokes, you can't do those kind of jokes. Okay, fine, I'll write something else. I used to tell comedians, when somebody's stealing your material, write faster, okay? Nobody wants to hear you bitch and moan and whine. You're a comedian. You're supposed to be funny. So don't be on TV unless you're funny. Right. I mean, I'm breaking my own rule right now.
Yeah. Well, that's another thing, you know, people always talk about comedy, and they always talk about being from a dark place, and that most comedians come up from screwed up childhoods or something horrible happened to them, and that brought them out of it. And I know you lost a brother later in life, but the stories right. about your mom and your dad, it seems like you had a good childhood. So
oh, I had a great childhood.
Yeah, so it doesn't seem like you're drawing from any terrible background that you had to pull yourself out of.
No. No, but I am a huge believer in low self-esteem.
Okay.
No, but I'll tell you what I mean by that. Mm-hmm. By that, I mean, if you don't think you're the smartest person in the room, you'll listen. I was, like I said, I was dyslexic. I'm the kind of guy, I go to Vegas, I got my car. Miss Leno, you have 28. What? You have 28.
Right.
The number is 21. Oh, okay, sorry. You know, so what I would do is, like when I did the Tonight Show, hire the best producer, best director, best lighting people, and let them do their job. My job is to write jokes, tell joke, get check. Let other people. I see so many comedians again. Now I want the lighting here. Now this should be this. I feel this should be that. Then you wind up with a bunch of pissed off employees, and they hate you. You know, we had the same people for 22 years, except for those that, you know, got a better opportunity or got married or did something else. For the most part, everybody stayed for 22 years because I let people just do their job. I let my attitude on the Tonight Show is anybody can pull the cord and stop the train. Like,
right.
Oh, I don't think that. I think, you know, I remember we had a transgendered person on the show and we had some joke that was kind of offensive and he came to me, or she came to me. I'm not being sarcastic here. And said it was really hurtful. I said, okay. And we took the joke out. And from that point on, I had the most loyal employee because I respected this person for what they were and didn't judge them. I said, okay, you were offended by that. And that spread throughout the rest of the staff. So people knew that I might have been, quote, the star of the show. But at any point, they could say, hey, this bothers me, or this is this, or this is that. And a lot of people would argue with me about things. Oh, you can't let people have that kind of power. But no, it's not. It made for a good workplace. We didn't have, besides the PR nonsense, we never had any of those kind of problems with sexual harassment or those kind of stuff. Because my door was always open. My attitude was you take the crappiest office in the middle of the room. You give the people who work the hardest the room with the bathroom and the nice view because they're going to be in that office a lot more than I am. And people, you know, when people see that you're the first one in and the last one out, they don't grudge you. I mean, the number of times I've worked with people who used to work on shows where I don't care if I lose my job as long as that guy loses his job. Sure. You know, it's that sort of scene from remember the Godfather goes, remember when Michael goes to Cuba and he sees a guy blow up himself just to take out three policemen? And you go, you don't want to be that guy.
Well, you know, you talk about taking that joke out and everybody she respected you for that. But comedy is almost always making fun of something or someone, either yourself for your own behavior, right, or making fun of someone else for their behavior. And let me interject this. I thought it was interesting when I heard you say you never make fun of groups. It's always just individuals and their behavior. But that's what comedy's about. We're making fun of stuff. And a comedian or comic has a different point of view and points out something that other people wish they'd thought of. And like, why didn't I think of that? And it makes them laugh. But where are we going with this culture where we can't, the rules have really changed of what you can and can't make fun of. So where's it going? Do you think it's that much different?
Well, what you said is the rules have changed. Mm-hmm. So change with the rules. I mean, think back. It wasn't that long ago. I remember Johnny used to do, lighten the loafers, all those kind of gay jokes and stuff like that. Think of the comedians that we know that worked the clubs that used to do sort of the ethnic jokes, making fun of the Chinese guy, making fun of the Japanese guy, making fun of the Polish guy, making fun of the Jewish guy. You don't see it anymore.
Sure.
But you see something else. You adapt or you die. Look, if people aren't laughing at your joke, you can't convince them that it's funny.
But I think the point, though, that everybody has is, and I think Disney addressed it amazingly with the episodes of The Muppet Show, where they're, you know, they came out and it said, it was wrong then and it's wrong now. So we're going to leave these episodes so we can all learn them and start discussions. So when we say you can't do that anymore, well, now it has to be backed up with, well, why can't you do it anymore? Just because you got caught? Or
I've been guilty of it myself, you know.
Sure. We all have. What comedian hasn't?
Right. Okay. Well, so what do? You either address it and you deal with it honestly, or you quit the business.
Right.
You know, I'm always amazed at comedians that go, you know, I'm not working that club anymore. I don't like this, you know, or I don't do colleges because college kids are too stupid now. Yeah.
Right.
No, you have to adapt yourself to what they think is funny. You know what's interesting? Mm-hmm. I remember years ago going to see Rickles. And when Rickles come out and do an ethnic joke,
right,
young people would go, whoa, and old people would laugh.
Right.
Mm-hmm. And then when Rickles, who never swore, would say shit on stage,
right,
go shit, like that.
Right.
The young people would roar with laughter, and the old people would go, whoa. So it was just a different.
Yeah.
You either change with the times or you don't. You know something? The pendulum swings both ways. It used to be way over here. Now it's way over here. But it will come back. It'll come back to the center.
Well, see, I think that all kind. You do it yourself. The self-deprecating humor. You're making fun of yourself. And
right.
I don't know if that evens it out. But I just wanted to interject this. What people don't know about you is that you weren't really from what I understand and what I saw is that you before the Tonight Show you weren't really a joke teller. Because I went to the Comedy Magic Club where you still go when there's no pandemic. You still go there just about every Sunday, right?
Right.
The room seats, what, 250, 270? And you still do the shows. But what I remember going there one Sunday. I was going there to see, I guess it was you. And I thought it was just going to be monologue jokes. And you did do that. You pulled out the paper, the cards, and then just read them without trying to sell the joke. You just read the words and you knew if they got a laugh that way that you could sell
that
the joke.
That was Johnny's advice.
Yeah. But what got me that night was hearing you tell stories. And I mean, I don't think I've ever laughed that hard at a comedian. I mean, your stories about your mom and your dad and the one about the VCR and all it was just, I don't think people can appreciate you as a performer until they go see you live, because what's on TV is you.
Well, that's different. I mean, Tonight Show monologue was really the headlines of the newspaper.
Right.
You made fun of what was in the news and then you moved on quickly. Right. You couldn't tell stories. I mean, I enjoy telling the stories. I mean, you know, something happened the other day and I had completely forgotten this. And you'll probably like this story. This is why I'm not allowed to buy furniture.
Okay.
When my wife and I got together, okay, we live together, we have a place, you know, we needed furniture. So we got to get a couch. And every couch at the time, and this is, you know, this is almost 40 years ago, was $1,200 to $1,800. It was like, it was crazy. I must make $10 on couch. So I'm just, one day I'm on 3rd Street in LA. I go past this shop and I see new couches, $250. I go, pull in. Like, what do you mean new couch? Oh, yeah, we make them right here, and it's a wood frame. And there was no cushion. There was no springs in the – it was just a wood frame with big sofa cushions, you know. So I sit on this couch, and I go, oh, this is okay. And I'm $250 is our basic, and it's $25 to deliver. I say, fine. Here you go. I'll buy it right now. I don't even have to ask my wife about this one.
Right.
So I buy it. I come home. I go, I bought a couch. They're delivering it tomorrow. Okay. So they bring in the wood frame. That's okay. And they bring in these big cushions, you know. I notice there's two guys carrying each cushion. They're so heavy, you know. And I put them down. So we sit on the cushion. My wife and I sit like – so we're sitting like – it doesn't go – we're sitting like this on the top of the – you know, like a cherry on the top of a cupcake or something, you know. And the guy goes, oh, yeah, just sit on it for a week, and it'll settle down, and it'll be comfortable. Okay. So after a week of sitting on this, my wife goes, you know, this thing is really uncomfortable. I said, look, honey, let me open the cushions, and I'll take out some of the foam, and that'll soften it up. She goes, right. So I unzip the thing, I reach in, and I pull out three pairs of men's underpants.
Oh, no.
The couch is
– come on.
It's just stuffed with rags and filthy clothes. Now my wife starts screaming, oh, get that thing out of here. I go, honey, I'll just zip it up. No, put the underwear back in.
Wow. So never I again.
I had to throw the whole couch out. And that is why, to this day, I'm not allowed to purchase furniture on my own.
That's great. Well, do you mind? I this is one that cracks me up every time I think about it, and my wife and I joke about it. And I hate doing this to you. But you, and I don't want to give it away, but you talked about getting older. And when you laid your motorcycle down and smashed into a tree versus, you know, do you know
actually,
what I'm talking about?
Yeah, there's two versions of that.
Okay.
I'll tell you another one. You know, I'm in the house one day and my wife turns on the lamp in the living room. Boom, the bulb blows. So I go looking for a ball. My wife says to me, you know, every time a ball blows, you go down to the pavilions or a supermarket and you buy one ball. Can you go to Home Depot, Lowe's, or just get like a box of bulbs? I said, you know something, honey? You're right. So I got down to Lowe's and I said, got a box of bulbs? Guy, okay. Guy brings out a box of bulbs on this side. I go, how much is that? He goes, $118. I go, $118? Why is it so much money? He goes, these are LEDs, Miss Lano. He says, these bulbs last 15 years. I said, you know, I'm 70 years old, okay? The chances of me seeing 85 are tenuous at best. I said, I don't want to die in 6 years, knowing for the next 9 years some yahoo is flicking the lights on and off of my dime. I said, give me the regular bulbs. I want bulbs that die when I die.
That's funny. Yeah.
Basically the same story.
Exactly. Well, the one I was talking about was where I don't want to give it away.
Okay. The thing was
– okay.
I was guest hosting on The Tonight Show.
Right.
I was guest hosting every Monday night. The preceding Friday, I'm riding my motorcycle, and I'm on Mulholland Drive. I'm going 85, 90, 95, pushing a bike over it. Come to the corner, hit some sand. The bike slides out from under me. Bike hits a tree. Bike just disintegrates. I slide along the pavement. My legs all kind of – ambulance takes me away. Saturday morning, wake up in the house, try to stand up. I can't move. My legs still sore. I can't move. Sunday, I get up, I walk a little bit. Monday, I walk out on stage like nothing happens. You know, 40 years old, you know, go walk out of the tunnel just like that. Last Thursday, I'm sitting on my couch. I yawn and turn my head at the same time. I'm ready to turn my head to what an idiot I was. You know, so basically it's like, yeah, it's not good getting old.
All right. So what you have coming up, it really interests me that you are going to be hosting You Bet Your Life this fall on Fox. Is that correct?
Yeah. I'm having a lot of fun. We've been doing run through. You know, it's great. I really enjoy it.
And the game show premise has pretty much stayed the same since Groucho Marx did it in 1947, right?
You know what it is? It's a comedy show. It's a comedy show where two people come out who don't know each other, and you sort of make fun of them as they try to guess what the answer is.
Right.
And Kevin Eubanks from The Tonight Show is doing it with me. So.
Oh, that's great. So what role does he play?
Well, he's going to be...
the announcer?
Kind of the announcer. Well, he'll be the music, and he'll also... Who are contestants? Jay, we got so-and-so from Oklahoma City, and so-and-so. And I will go to Kev occasionally and ask him about this.
Oh, that's nice. So he'll have the band and the whole thing. So it's kind of a...
no band, just Kevin.
Just Kevin and his guitar. That's it?
Yeah, but I you know, we've been doing run-throughs with regular people, and it's off the cuff. They can't write for it because, you know, it happens so quickly. It's all ad-lib, but it's great fun. And I think it's going to do very, very well. It's really good. We got the secret word and all that kind of stuff.
And that's why Groucho was so good at, because he was so great at ad lib, and that's the reason he got the gig. And I suppose that's the reason you got the gig, right?
I hope so.
Yeah. Well, the other two hosts, because they've brought this. What's interesting to me is that every network has had this show. First, it was ABC Radio. It was in radio days. Then it was CBS Radio. Then it was NBC Radio. Then it was NBC TV. And now it's going to be Fox TV. So it's run the gamut. But can we mention the past hosts besides Groucho Marx? I don't understand. In 1980, Buddy Hackett. Have you seen the films? Was he good at it?
I didn't see Buddies, no. I saw Cosby did it.
Yeah, Cosby started it in 92. I don't know how long it lasted. But that had to have been pretty good.
I think it lasted two seasons.
Right.
I mean, it's not. I can't really comment on why other. You know, I think other people have their strengths.
And you're having fun with it, because that's the most important part. You'd quit if it wasn't fun, right?
See, I like people. When I was doing The Tonight Show, I know Johnny and Letterman used to say, you never talk to the guests before the show begins. But I always like to make them feel comfortable. I always hated comedy where people are uncomfortable and you're in the position of power and you're kind of nailing them. And it's not their wheelhouse. You know, they're nervous. To me, I would go in and I'd say, listen, just have fun out there. Be loose. And then people would obviously embarrass themselves. And, you know, when we did jaywalking on The Tonight Show, we never pre-interviewed anybody. We would just...
And again, I got to set it up. There's some younger folks out there who might not know. Jaywalking is when you went on... Basically, you're over... All was at Universal, right?
No, we go to Melrose Avenue and we just walk up to people and we go, excuse me, can I ask you? And we always tried to, you know, we didn't get the homeless guy with both pupils in the same eye. We're not looking for any kind of people with sort of problems. Just nicely dressed, normal people.
Right.
My favorite question was, how is Mount Rushmore formed? And the number of people said erosion.
Wow. So, amazing. And those are all legitimate people. But you'd make
we never had a setup. I would say we never talked to more than 18 or 20 people, and we always used at least 12.
Did you make them sign stuff before or after they were on?
After they were on. We're not there to, you know.
But would anybody say, no, I was an idiot, I don't want to be on TV, ever?
Once in a while. Yeah. But for the most part, they knew we were having fun, and they realized their answer was silly and all that kind of stuff. You know, the best part was the people had no idea what they were wearing. I remember talking to one guy, and he had the Something Company on his T-shirt. I said, you ever heard of this company? He goes, no, what do they do? they're in whatever business it was. You right. sure you don't know them? No. You've never seen – no, I've never heard that name before. And then they look at their shirt and realize how stupid that sounded. But the number of people who put on clothes that have no idea what they say was astounding to me.
That's amazing. Well, look, Jay, during the pandemic, you have not, from what I can see, you have not slowed down. I mean, it's you're still working. And tell me if these numbers are wrong. When there's no pandemic, it averages about 200 shows a year. Is that right?
Yeah, about 210, yeah.
Okay. So you still go to the Comedy Magic Club on Sunday nights just for fun or to try out material?
No, the Comedy Magic Club has been closed.
When there's no pandemic.
Yeah.
And you still go. And what is the main purpose of that? Is it to help Mike Lacy out, or do you just love it, or to try out material?
Well,
I think
above? A little bit of both.
Yeah.
I like Mike, and it was fun to place to perform. You know, I liked it because you got a regular audience. Sometimes when you just work in Hollywood, you wind up with a Hollywood crowd, and it gets a little snarky. The great thing about the Comedy Magic Club is it's Orange County. It's near the airport, so you get a lot of people that are in L.A. for a night or two. Oh, comedy club, let's go in there. So they're from all around the country, and you get a good sense of what real people laugh at. Because sometimes when you're in the L.A. clubs, the acts are so filthy. It doesn't mean they're not funny, but they're so filthy. Most people go, whoa, geez, that's a little raw for me, you know. And you don't get a true feel of what the room is like, you know. So I always liked it because the Comedy Magic, it was just a good room. I've been there every Sunday except for this year since 1978.
That's amazing. But, you know, most guys would have walked off the set of The Tonight Show after 22 years, was it, and said, that was fun, I'm done. But you just kept pushing it. I mean, most of the guys would have grown a long gray beard and said, that's it, maybe done a couple of things. But
I was in Florida. You know something? I never considered TV a real job. I've always had two income streams. You live on one and you bank the other. When I was a kid, I worked at McDonald's. I worked at a place called Wilmington Ford. And I'd bank my McDonald's money and spend the Wilmington Ford money. And that's and when I got to Tonight Show, I figured, I don't know how long this is going to last. We've all known people that got a TV show, forgot their act because they were starring in a TV show. The TV show ended and they were left with nothing.
Yeah.
They didn't have anything. To me, I would bank my TV money and I would live off my stage money. And I would do about 150 dates a year. I was out every Friday, Saturday, and Sunday. And sometimes if it's west of the Mississippi, Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday, like Vegas or somewhere, I could get back in time to do the show. And that always worked for me because I knew I'm a stand-up comedian who's just lucky enough to get a TV show. This TV show could end at any time. But the stand-up's not going to end because I can always go somewhere in stand-up. You know, I
until the until the pandemic.
Well, that's what I mean. I figured something would take me out.
Yeah.
Motorcycle accident, stroke, heart attack. I never thought I would be fine and the audience would go away. I really thought it'd be the other way around. But that's what happened with the pandemic. You couldn't have an audience anywhere. You couldn't go anywhere in the world. You know, I like to work on cars, so I would call friends who make stuff in Argentina. Oh no, pandemic. France, Wales, Scotland. This is the whole world. I mean, it's just amazing that you, the fact is there's not a club anywhere. I mean, now it's starting to open up a little bit, but as I said, March 17th was the last time I was on stage.
Well, you know, what impresses me about you is that it's just been, it seems like such a solid, straightforward career and life because of the simplicity of it. You haven't complicated it with divorces or any of that stuff.
No.
It's cars and comedy. And it's an enviable position to be in, but it's just a lot of wisdom along the way. So my wife wanted me to ask you, and I'm curious too, how did you and Mavis meet?
Well, it's kind of funny. I've lived with five women in my life. They're all born on the same day, including Mavis.
What?
I wasn't looking for that. I'm just attracted to women that were born on September 5th for some reason. I met Mavis. She was in the audience, and we've been together ever since. That was 41 years ago.
In the audience where?
It's a comedy store.
And you met and...
I saw her in the audience, and then what happened? Well, I saw her get up and go to the restroom, so I got off stage and immediately ran back to where the restrooms were. Hey, oh, I just saw you coming out of there. How you doing? Nice to see you. You know, and started talking right there, you know.
And that was, you know, that was it?
Yeah, that was it. That was it. It's, you know, I always say behind every successful man, there's a woman, and behind every unsuccessful man, there are two women. You
know? Wow.
And that's,
yeah.
Like people always say, oh, the key to a good relationship is communication. No, the key is really not screwing around.
Wow.
If you don't believe me, screw around, then try communicating. Let me know how that goes for you.
Sure.
And you know, and that's worked out fine. That's worked out good for me. I really like being married. I have a great marriage. We have a lot of fun. I make my wife laugh. That's my favorite thing.
You know, she still does.
Yeah, like, you know, the other night, you know, I'm asleep. It's like 2 o'clock in the morning. My wife goes, I get this time. She goes, honey, I just want to tell you I love you. I said, you're having a nightmare. Go back to bed.
And she laughed.
She thought that was like the funniest, thing. And it made me laugh. And, you know, there are people who just inspire you to do what it is you do. And you know, that's, you know, what was the other thing she said the other day? She goes, what did I do to deserve you? And I said, honey, I was thinking the exact same thing.
That's great.
And yet she's not offended by that. She sees the humor in it.
Sure.
Like, oh, okay. And then, oh, I can, well, maybe I can use that, you know.
That's so, this is the sweetest stuff I've ever heard you say about her. I mean, are there, getting personal, are there still flowers? Do you still romance her a little bit? Or is it that sounds like more than just friends.
Yeah, I mean, that's how you do it, isn't it? I mean, it just seems like common sense. You know, I'm someone, the key to life, shoot for contented. Because you can't be happy all the time. It's like drinking champagne every day. You just wind up an alcoholic. And if you're happy every day, then you never know what happiness is. It's to shoot for contented with sort of spurts into happiness. And that's always worked for me. You know, I always would tell people, marry your conscience. Marry the person you wish you could be. You know, my wife does a lot of work with women in Afghanistan and with women's rights and helping, you know, we try to bring over, or she does, try to bring over a couple of girls every year from Afghanistan so they can go to college and get an education and stuff like that. And, you know, and I think that's really the key, to marry the person you wish you could be. And I don't think she did that, obviously, but but it worked out okay for me. Yeah.
Well, one last thing here. I want to say I have enjoyed chatting with you, and you and I became acquaintances because of the Tonight Show and when I'd come on and do the goofy sketches with Walter and all that. And
then lovers briefly, which was interesting.
I know, but you know, we didn't talk about that afterward, and we're not going to talk about it now. But I remember going to the car shows every once in a while and chatting with you, and you were always approachable. And this is fun for me to be able to have this conversation now, because this business is, in your position, it's so difficult to know who can be a friend and who can't be, and who isn't a friend, because you never know. And I always felt so sorry for Carson and for you, and because you don't know. Everybody seems to be want something from you, and I have a teeny bit of that now and then, and I have a handful of good friends, and I'm sure you do too. But it's tough. And you know, Letterman said, when he talked about Carson, he said talking to Johnny Carson the first time is like talking to the guy in the $5 bill. And I would bet Carson is to you as you are to me. And it's just really fun to hear the human side and to be able to have a real conversation with somebody like you that I guess has to be really guarded.
I don't have to be really guarded. I mean, to me, if somebody wants something from me, I give it to them. It's after they go away, you go, oh, okay, well, that person just wanted that. Well, that's all right.
Right.
That's fine. You know, I think you have to genuinely like people, and you have to be willing to forgive them. They know not what they do, type of deal. You know, you just sort of, you know, I'll tell you a funny story. I'll tell you my road rage story. One day I'm in traffic and this guy behind me, beep, 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 he's honking, you know? So I go, go around me, go around me. So I pull off to the side. As he goes around me, he gives me the finger, you know? So I pull up the light and I go, what was that all about? And he starts yelling at me,
right,
swearing at me. So being a comic, you know how this works.
Yep.
To me, he's like a heck. I look at him. I said, let me guess. You're 50. You're fat. You're bald. You're divorced. Your kids hate you. Your best day was, what, high school? Maybe. That was about it. But down here. And then the guy starts crying.
Oh, no.
And I go, oh, wait, pull over, pull over. Okay.
Oh, so man.
Now I get in his car, and he's like.
You got in his car?
Yeah, I got in his car. I said, okay. You okay? He said, no, you're right. Everything you said is true. I said, well, how old are your kids? He goes, I got two girls, like 12 and 14, and they hate me. I said, do your kids like Taylor Swift? Oh, yeah, they love Taylor Swift. I said, look, I got Taylor Swift on the show next Wednesday. I tell you what, why don't you come to the show? You bring your kids. I'll give you a couple of tickets. I'll introduce your kids to Taylor Swift. As the guy brings his kids, and of course, Taylor Swift couldn't be nicer. Gives each girl a CD and signs it, and all this thrilled. And the guy and I kind of became, well, not friends, but it was okay. It was okay. And I realized, you know, it's like more flies with honey, you know?
But, Jay, that's amazing. And that's what people don't know about you that aren't around you. They don't realize that you really are that kind of guy, and you don't fake your sincerity. And it's just
Only now. Only, this is the only time I'm faking now. It.
All right, last question. People are going to want to know, and I know you hate this question. Can you tell me how many cars, how many vehicles? I know it's almost split 50-50 between motorcycles and cars. Can you tell? It's more than 50.
You sound like there's 199 cars registered and 168 motorcycles.
Is that right? Wow.
Yeah.
All right. And every one of them is drivable almost, and you have fun with them, right?
I hope so.
That's great. Well, Mr. Leno, thank you very much for this time.
Thanks, Jeff. Bye-bye.
Well, there you go. That was fun.
Oh, yeah. Jay Leno, good guy. Always wearing denim.
That's right.
Is that why you're wearing denim right now?
Yeah, in honor of Jay.
Oh, it's good. It's great. You called each other and decided to wear the same thing.
Exactly.
Yeah. You always see it in the denim, don't you, guys? Always.
Yeah.
I don't think I've ever seen him without it.
Yeah.
Yeah. Right. Always in denim, and except for when he would do the Tonight Show or perform somewhere, and even when he performed certain places to try out material, he wore denim.
Oh, it's fascinating. Thanks, Jeff.
Isn't that great? Yeah. I know all about his denim.
He could go on all day long.
All right, so now we got a clip.
Oh, good. We have the comedy clip at the end of the podcast now, and this is the one with me doing what?
No, you're not in this one.
What?
No, this is just me.
I'm not in this? No. Oh, I don't care. Okay, folks, time to go click to Joe Rogan. He has a much bigger audience.
because of Jay being a car guy, we picked a clip from Spark of Insanity.
And no one cares.
This is me in the Prius bit.
No one cares. Click to something else.
Here it is.
No one cares.
My wife and I live in L.A., and we, not long ago, were the proud owners of two big giant SUVs, and we decided to do the economically and ecologically right thing. We got rid of one of the big giant SUVs and got a Prius. I don't know what you're laughing at. It's a great vehicle. You jump on the freeway and putch, and it goes... You can drive underneath an 18-wheeler and go, that is really dirty, and drive back out. That is just too damn small. It is kind of cool when you go to the gas pump to fill up, because in one tank you've driven like 2,000 or 3,000 miles, and you go and fill up, it's like, oh, all done, I'll be damned. 10 cents, that's amazing! Not used to a vehicle like this, so I've always had big trucks and big SUVs, and the one vehicle I refuse to get rid of, I've had it for 10 years, it's paid for, I love this thing, I've taken good care of it. I know it's not politically correct to drive it anymore, but I don't care. It's the H1 Hummer, the real one, the big one, the military version. I love this thing. It has a 38-gallon tank. Gets 7 miles to the gallon. Diesel, where I live at its peak, was $3.84 a gallon. Yeah, I went to fill it up that week. It wasn't even empty. It cost me $148. I pushed the vehicle home. As it rolled into the driveway, I called my kids out and I said, girls, look at our new front yard ornament. Get in the Prius. You sucked at it.
Well, that's it for this week. Be sure and join us next week for our next podcast.
Oh, is it going to be next week? It always is. Okay, good. Yeah, you can get your Apple podcast or your favorite podcast provider. No one knows. No one cares.
Watch it on YouTube or on Facebook.
Oh, great. Yay. See it everywhere. Yeah.
Be sure and subscribe, like, and comment.
And also hit the notifications bell. And by the way, why the hell are you guys here?
Oh, yeah, I don't know.
No one knows.
We can't leave?
No one cares. Fine.
Silence! I kill you!